Hey, everybody, it's hour number three of this week's Blues Before Sunrise, the Blues Heritage Showcase. I'm your host, Steve Cushing. Of course, hour number three is the hour when we focus on pre-war blues and gospel recordings. When I say pre-war, before World War II, the earliest recordings. I find that as the years have gone by, as much as I appreciate the music and the people who made the music, I also have developed an appreciation for the people who have supported and promoted the music over these years. And this hour, we're going to feature a guy who actually has won a name for himself by supporting pre-war blues, a fellow by the name of Johnny Parth, who's originally out of Germany or Austria, I believe. Johnny just died recently. He died May 9th of this year, 2025, at the age of 95. And Johnny made a name for himself with the following project, and let me explain. Starting in 1964, there was a guidebook for all of the recordings that were made prior to World War II, all the blues and gospel recordings that were made prior to World War II. I guess the recording ban of during World War II took place August 1st of 1942, but all the records up to that point were listed in this book. And what it was, it was a very thick volume that listed all of the artists and all of their recordings. And it did the date for each recording session, the people who were included playing on the record label that it was issued on originally. It's called a discography, and that was the pre-war discography. And a couple of guys, Bob Dixon, Robert Dixon, and John Godrich, did the first book in 1964, and it's been revised a couple of times. I think we're currently on the fourth edition, and in addition to Godrich and Dixon, Howard Rye, who has helped update and added current cross-reference sections to the thing, done some valuable work with it too. It's now in the fourth edition. I mention all this because the fellow we're about to hear from, Johnny Parth, was a fan of pre-war blues. First, he was a jazz fan, and then he heard pre-war blues recordings. I think Blind Lemon was his first guy, and fell in love with pre-war recordings, pre-war blues. And he loved it so much that he started his own little reissue labels, taking the old 78s and recording them and making LPs out of them. So instead of listening to one side and A or B side of the same 78, you would listen to 10 tracks or 12 tracks. And it was his dream to, he said that he was frustrated with the way that the vintage recordings were reissued, because there were some artists that you got to hear a lot about. You had many reissues, and some artists that were never reissued at all. And those that were reissued, you would hear the same sides over and over again. And he had this dream to take the entire blues discography, everybody in it, and each of their records, and list them in chronological order, in the order that they had been recorded, which was a monumental, almost impossible dream, except that during the 1990s, he actually pulled that off. What he did was he solicited a network of vintage blues record collectors around the globe and asked them if they would volunteer, make recorded copies of their 78s, make tape recordings of their vintage recordings, and send them to him, and he would... First, he started out reissuing on LP, and then he switched about 2 years into the project over to CDs, which was, at that point, the new platform to present music on. And I, you know, as the years gone by, I said I appreciate more the people who supported the music. And my latest book, which is called Blues Before Sunrise Number 3, Guitar Slinger and Backbeaters from the University of Illinois Press, has an extended interview with Johnny Parth as he tells the story about how he discovered the music and his involvement with first a reissue label that he founded called the Roots Label, and then the Document Project. And we're about to listen to the extended interview that I did with Johnny. This was back in 2007. And I should also tell you that the sound quality is not real good. This was a phone interview. It was done on an international line. Not only was it an international line, but it was a mobile phone line from Italy. And I recorded on my end on a phone conference unit, which not only plays back the person that you're listening to loud in the room, but it also records your voice, sending it to the other end. So the sound quality is real tricky. The phone line, I had three phone cards, phone credit cards that were worth $50 a piece, and I used up the first two and most of the third one recording this. It runs a little over 30 minutes here, and I hope you, as you do with many of the recordings on this program, that you will ignore the sound quality and listen to what's being said as we talk to Johnny Parth, who founded and guided the Document Project. It's 900 CDs of vintage pre-war blues and gospel. Here's Johnny Parth.
I'm born in Vienna on the 11th of January, 1930. My father was a clerk, and he worked several places. And my mother was at home all the time. There were three of us kids. I was the oldest, and my brother is about 10 years younger than I, and my sister is 12 years younger than I. I went to school in Vienna all my life. And during the war, the first thing was that our house was bombed, and my father was in war. He was not at home. So my mother and the little brother that I had, who had to leave Vienna, and we were on the way for about 300 kilometers walking and living on the countryside, you see, because everything was bombed, so we couldn't stay in Vienna. And short time before the war was over, the peasant where we lived, he was a Nazi, and he had a foreign laborer, and he gave him the food just as much that he needed for a living, you see. And I made friendship with this guy. He was Polish, and he was always hungry, and he slept in the stable with the horses, you see, on the floor. And once I was so sad about his fate that I went to the kitchen and took a lot of bread and meat from there and brought it to him in the stable. And then came another friend there where I lived in the countryside. He was the son of the father was an important person, and he told me that on the post office is a letter for me from the army. So they wanted me to take me with 14 years of age to the army. And then I left my mother and everything. I didn't even tell her, and I was gone. I lived 1.5 months in the woods, because if they would have found me, they would have killed me or something like that, you see. And there was a terrible time, because I was not seen in the daytime. I was always in the woods, and only in the evening I went to the peasants and asked them if they had something to eat for me. And that lasted about 1 week, and then the war was over. I saw people in the woods with these striped clothes. They were from the concentration camps. They were free now. And then I could go among other people again. This was the hardest time of my life, believe me. When the war was over, I was 15 years of age. But when I was 14, I had some friends from the which were in the underground, and this was my first the first time when I came in contact with jazz music. And this changed all my, all the education that I had was gone. You see, that this music fascinated me so much that I stood in these circles, and we came together once a week, and I was not allowed to talk to tell anybody that we listened to an English to BBC London. You see, that was prohibited. This was the first time that I heard jazz music. So in the German and Austrian radio, you could only hear operas, Wagner, or marching music, or folk music, things like that. Yeah. Then a friend of mine, for a school friend, I visited him, and he said, "You must listen to something." And he played St. Louis Blues by Louis Armstrong. This was the first time in my life that I heard a jazz record, and was so fascinated that I wanted to hear more of this kind of music. And they said, "Yes, you can, but you must promise that you don't tell anybody, even not your parents and nobody at all, because if somebody will get the information that we come together, they will lock us in jail." And so I had to swear that I do not tell anybody. And so we met once a week, and they played BBC London, and there were jazz on the radio. And that was strictly prohibited during Hitler time. And every half hour, there was a break, and they made news in German language. And then I heard for the very first time in my life of the concentration camps and all these things. I couldn't believe it, but they told me that even relates of them, of the school friend, were also in the concentration camp. And so it was a very, very hard situation for me, that I was not allowed to tell to my parents, because I couldn't believe that they sympathized with such a politic, you see. So I couldn't even ask them if they knew about this, you see. This was very hard for me because I was 14 years of age. A year later, the war was over, and then I promised this. Jazz was for me the meeting with jazz music, that was for me the most important thing of my life, because all the education was gone, and I promised that I will, all my life, I will work for this kind of music to get people together and so on. And this was the beginning of everything, you see. After the war, I was a very good painter, and so my father, when he came back from war, he sent me to an art school. First I went to high school, and from there to the art school. And then I became a portrait painter. And most of my life I painted portraits. I loved music more, but I was not a musician, you see. I was just a fan. I learned a little bit trumpet playing, but I was an amateur. But I was a very good painter, and so this was for a long time my profession. And I also began to collect records. That was by the end of the 40s, because no records were available in Austria at that time, only a few from private people, and it was very hard to get records. 1950s, early 50s, 1952 or 53, there was a club in Vienna, a private club. It was called Hot Club de Vienne. And I went there, and I could hear some recitals about jazz music and blues music. And after the third time, when I was there for the third time, and I came there, all the people were standing on the street in front of the cafe house where we had the club. So I said, what happened? They said, "No, the rent wasn't paid, so they don't let us in." So I said, just a moment, I said, and I went downstairs, because I came from a company for which I made a portrait. And I had some money in my pocket, and I went to the owner of the cafe and said, "When I pay the rent for the club, can we come in?" And she said, "Yes, okay." So I paid it, then I went upstairs and said, "We can go down to the club, and I'm your new president." And the next year they chose me, you know. For the first time, it was not democratic. I said, "I'm your new president, and we carry on with the club." recitals about music and with records, no live music, you see. And then sometimes also live musicians came. One of them was Joe Zawinul, who is very famous in America. He died in Vienna a few weeks ago. You probably know his group. He played with Miles Davis. He was very, but no bluesman.
Can you tell me how you made the transition from being a jazz fan to being a blues fan?
Also came later in my life, you see. First I heard was jazz and music, blues music that was in the 50s when I first heard blues. That fascinated me even more than jazz. During the time when I had the jazz club, I had a lot of ideas. I thought we could make the Blue Danube River to the Mississippi. So I asked the people who managed the shipping on the Danube if it would be possible to rent a ship and with jazz bands on board and make riverboat shuffles like in America. I said, okay, let's try it. So and I loaned money from all my friends, and we got enough to rent the ship. And this was the first riverboat shuffle. That was 1956, I think. Exactly 51 years ago. A few riverboat shuffles. Then I had the idea to ask a priest if he would like to have gospel music in his church. Maybe just try it if what the people will say. And then I arranged the first Catholic jazz mass in Austria. We got really problems with the places, you know. Then I made some arrangements to make concerts with jazz musicians. I met many jazz musicians like Louis Armstrong, Lionel Hampton. Oh, many, many. I cannot. The first blues record that I heard was Blind Lemon Jefferson. That was an LP that came out in America on the Riverside label, in Europe on a 10-inch London label. And this fascinated me very much, and I tried to listen to more of this kind of material, and I found people who had records, and they sent them to me so that I could hear them, and I taped them, and that was the beginning of my blues interest. 50s. 57, 58. Print out the country blues. The document label, that was pretty late. I had labels before, you know, during the when I was the president of the Hot Club de Vienne. I made the first private pressings of long playing records with 30 copies each. So I made everything myself, the covers and everything, but they were pressed. And I sold them only in the club, not officially. And these were issues of early 78, King Gulliver's Creole Jazz Band, Louis Armstrong's Hot Five, and such things, you see. And then I put out the first blues album. It was a three-volume set anthology of the blues, also on the Jazz Perspective label. And I made more of this kind, and later came the Roots label. I think it was in the 60s, end of the 60s. Roots was also my label, yeah? Yeah, they were mine. They were mine together with my second wife, with Evelyn. I had a big collection, and a friend of mine in London, Pete Seeger, he was working on the fish market. He sold my whole collection. I needed money one day, and then I decided to sell my complete 78 collection. First, my favorite records, then it's easier to sell the others. So I began with my favorites to get rid of them, and then I started with LPs. Then I sold my LP collection when I had no money, and put everything on cassettes. And I wasn't happy with the cassettes, and then I began with LPs again. And then I had no money again, and then I began with CDs.
How many LPs did you issue on the Roots label?
Oh, let me think. I can only say approximately about 60.
How many copies of each LP on the Roots label did you press?
100. Of the Roots, 100 copies. 100 copies, yeah. And if I needed more, I pressed another 100. But this was only very few times. Parallel to the jazz or blues issues. I also made recordings of Austrian folk music, also early recordings of Viennese folk music, which I got from collections here in Vienna. I must recapitalize this. It's difficult. I remember a Bank Johnson double album, yeah? The blues box. Then the history of jazz, a 10 LP box. That was the Hot Club. That was not Roots. No, Roots was special. Roots was not that. There was only blues on Roots. There was no jazz, I think. There was only... you see, I mixed this in my brain together. One part was that was also about 50 or 60 issues in the Hot Club TVN. On the Hot Club, on Jazz Perspective labels, and there were a lot of labels. One label was called New Orleans. That was mostly jazz. But then with my second wife, Evelyn, she was also a great blues fan. She was a musician. She played harpsichord. She was Bach playing. She was also a great blues fan, and at that time, that was when I started with Roots, with her together, and we made only blues recordings, yeah.
How did the Roots label come to an end?
It ended when we got divorced, and that was, just a moment, so difficult for me. I should prepare this for another talk. I married the first time when I was 21. That was in 1951. Was married 6 years. That was 1957. A few months later, I married my second wife, Evelyn, and was together 12 years. And then she got a friend of mine and left me. And then, about 6 months later, I met my third wife. She was 25 years younger than I, very beautiful, and we were married 32 years, and she left me 2 years ago, if you got that all, you see. So the document, there was a long interval where I did not any records at all, you see, where I went back to painting again. I made my money with painting. I was not happy with that. We sometimes hadn't enough to eat. We had to go to the neighbors and ask to lend us money that we can buy bread. And this was a very hard life. After that, I got the idea to start again with LPs. And this was the beginning of Document. There are so many interesting items which never have been issued. And so many titles which come out over and over again on several different labels, you see? And all this duplication made me crazy. And so I said, no, what I want to do is to put out everything, every artist complete and in chronological order. But there were about 2 years when I made Document LPs, and then came the CD, and then I began in August 1990 with CDs.
How many Document LPs did you press?
300, yeah, that was the minimum we had to press. 300 was the...
On Document CDs, how many CDs did you press of each title?
500 and repressings 100.
Collectors worldwide donated recorded copies of their 78s for your use in the Document series. How did you contact them?
I called them all. How did I make contact with you? I do not know from everybody whom I called, whom I wrote a letter, and some people called me, so I hadn't to do anything. And there was a collector in Canada, Roger Misiewicz. He made contact. He had many contacts. And he made contacts between them, between the collectors and me. Very helpful.
Were there collectors who refused to participate and wouldn't provide copies of their 78 recordings?
Yeah, but very, very seldom. The most gave me, and for some of them I had to pay, sometimes very much, sometimes not much. And by the most didn't ask for anything. They just wanted me to put it out. I paid for the composer's rights to the Austro-Americana. But the collectors who taped that 78 for me, some asked for money, some wanted just free copies, but didn't ask for anything. They just were happy that I have put that out. The collectors who had the 78, they taped it. They didn't send me the 78 because it's too dangerous that they break. So they taped them for me. Put them on big reels, and some put them on just on cassettes. And I went to the studio, and in the studio we tried to improve the sound quality. Can you tell me which titles did you send me? Ah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I have listed all the people where the originals came from, but I don't know myself now which titles came from which person, you know? This is the problem.
Who handled the sound quality?
Studio. A musician. He's a very good musician. He has a sound studio. He makes recordings with very prominent Austrian musicians and also with star guests, and so he's very busy. And he's a good friend of mine, and he made me a special prize. And I came to him to the studio with all the tape material and with a compilation list, and then we started. And I said all the time I was there, and I said, no, please give more treble or more filter, or so just for, as my ears thought it is better. Sometimes we discuss if it sounds better this way or that way, and that's how we work together.
What was his name?
His name? Gerhard Wessely. Wessely. You can read that where the titles are. You can see the name of the studio and the sound engineer. First, I had another one. I had Hans Clement. He was the first, but he was a heavy drinker, alcoholic, and then I changed and went to Gerhard Wessely. This is the Soundborn Studio, the name of his studio, Soundborn Studio.
Also, I've been wondering, who assigned the liner notes for each of the CDs?
The people asked me if I want them to do this or that, and then we discussed this mostly. Some people told me who is better in this case and who is better in that case, and then I contacted them, and some writers called me and asked if they wanted to do it, you see? It's very, very democratic, the whole thing. There was a lot of cooperation. I couldn't have done anything without the help of so many people.
Were there any major disasters, things that had to be redone?
No, I don't remember. No. There were some which didn't sell at all, but I knew this when I produced them. I knew that nobody will buy 9 volumes of Reverend Gates just talking and preaching, you see. But I had to do it because it belongs to the whole project. But there are others which sell better, and always when I had a good runner, as we call it, then I could make something which doesn't sell at all.
Also, how did you decide who you would leave out of the document series?
Who I would leave out? Didn't leave out anything if it was available to me. Oh, yeah, I know what you mean, yeah. Those which were already available in chronological order on another label. And I also announced that I will put it out on document if it is deleted on the other label. I had also contact with all these producers. Larry Cohn is a very good friend of mine. He visited me 5 or 6 times in Austria.
We talked about the liner notes on your CDs. Who did the cover art?
You know, I'm a graphic artist. I also made a lot for, before I made the portraits, I made a lot for companies in Vienna for clothes and for cosmetics and all these things, posters, you know. Yes. So that was no problem for me. I made the covers, and a friend of mine is a computer expert. He made that on, put that on the computer, and that was all.
I assume that when the word went out that you had started this project, the document label, and began to receive tapes from the various collectors, you would receive more than one copy of some titles. How did you decide which copy of the same title to use?
We compared them in the studio exactly which one sounds best. We always tried to guess the best available copy. If only a very bad copy was available, no other one was could be found, then I had to use it to put out the complete works. But it's easy to make a best-of collection, you see, but you only take the material which is in best condition. But I sometimes had to also to use very bad copies. Sometimes a tape, you know, and this sounds horrible, but cannot avoid it.
Are there still any titles missing from your catalog?
Absolutely not. No, that's what I've done. I have made private for some of my friends 12 volumes, which count document test with the number 001 to 012. And there is all the material which was found later, which came out during the years when I have stopped with documents. So they are just for myself and for friends. So if you're interested, you can also be included if you like. But they are homemade. How I have decided to sell them? I have a long-time friendship with Chris Strachwitz, you see. And he was also behind Roots. He helped me to how I have to do the whole thing. He was my teacher. And then, you know, this is the Ahuli label, Chris Strachwitz, Ahuli Records. And he also informed me when I should change to CD and so on. And he also distributed them in the United States, which was very important. And the English distributors, they just called me on the phone. I didn't make very much. The first years, I sold most material to collectors, privately. But then came the distributors, and yeah, there was the problem that my wife, she liked blues, but she always said, you have no time for the family. You work 16 hours every day, even on Saturday, Sunday. That was necessary. So she wanted me to have more time for her. There was 70 years old, and I said, okay, that's the time to finish. And I also spoke to Gary Atkinson, who bought the whole stuff, that I will continue to work for him. I will compile them for him. I will get the material from the collectors, and he just has to put them out.
I know you issued CDs of White String Bands. Is there a discography for that type of music? And if not, how did you select which acts to be included in the genre?
There was no discography, but Tony Russell. It was his idea that I should make the white music, and he gave me all the information. He sent me the material. He compiled the CDs, because I do not know much about the white music, you see. And I told him that some people who collect white music wanted me to do that, and I said, okay, I'll do it, but you must promise me that whenever I stop, because I'm not the youngest, so when I want to stop with producing, then do not swear at me or something. You see, so they all agreed, and Tony Russell then sent me the material, and he wrote the notes, and he did everything. Spent the money and went to the studio, and that's all. They finished the project in July 1999, 880 CDs. When I was 70, I'm 78 now, almost 78 in 2 months, after 78. When I was 70, I stopped working, and I sold the whole thing. And there were the following problems. There were three American producers who were interested in buying it from me, but they didn't accept one point that every number, also if it doesn't sell anymore, must be repressed when it runs out. You see? Nothing is allowed to be deleted. This was my condition. If you're interested, I got a high price in Memphis, Tennessee in 2001 for my project, for my work. Did you know that? I was invited with my family. And that was a blues festival there, and they gave it the Keeping the Blues Alive Award. It's you know, the W.C. Handy Award is for active musicians, and the Keeping the Blues Alive Award is for other people who work with blues. And I got it in 2001, and 1 year after that, I got in Vienna a gold medal also for the same work. The Library of Congress, I told you that already, they got all my material without any payment, just that they can stock it and that they can put it on the next. If another technique is available on the market, sound technique, I mean, then they change it every few years. But it's this way it will always be available. I also love the project. You see, it was my life, the most important thing in my life, more than the hot club and all these things.
And just to remind you, the interview that you've been listening to is with the late Johnny Parth. Johnny, who was responsible for vintage blues records being reissued on first LP and then CD earlier on the Roots label, and then he had this gigantic, just overwhelming project, the Document label, which ran 900 CDs and was supposed to, and in fact, for the most part, did, reissue everything in the pre-war discography in chronological order, all the artists in chronological order. Johnny died May 9th of 2025 at the age of 95, and we just take time to salute him and all the great work that he did. By the way, when we were talking about things that were not reissued, that he didn't reissue, the sides by Bessie Smith were all on Columbia, and those were issued and stayed in print. Also, Robert Johnson on Columbia and didn't get reissued by Johnny Parth. They stay in print. And I can think of a couple of others like Calvin Frazier, Samson Pittman. Also, Edith North Johnson, her records were not reissued by Johnny, but they were readily available. In the time that's left, what do you say we select some sides out of the Document catalog? And if you're a regular listener, you're probably familiar with these because these are among my favorites of the pre-war recordings.
I will come every morning. Brian Kenny, run my bit. Run your somebody. Biggie Kenny, do. Run your song and take it. Kenny, do. Right, mama. Mama, mama, right, Kenny, killing me, bleed to my soul, no, they gon' kill me, dead.
I'm just want to give you a good talk.
Amen.
Yes. This evening on this subject.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Gasoline and corn liquor.
Yes.
Corn liquor and gasoline won't mix.
No, it won't. Uh-huh. I know that.
And when you get gasoline and corn liquor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Gas in the car.
Yeah.
And corn liquor in the man's head.
Uh-huh.
Or the woman's head.
Yeah.
You're going to have a combustion.
Yes,
you're
you
going to be either wreck.
Yeah.
Death.
Yeah.
A hospital stay.
All right.
You don't mind? Jail.
Yeah.
From there, ting-gang. From there, you're on the highway for hell.
Yeah.
Gasoline. And automobile.
Yeah.
And corn liquor.
Yeah.
See, I tell you, it's three bad mixed up brothers.
Yes, yes.
And now I saw a car going the other day, and I seen somebody in it, but I couldn't make out just who it was. And I wonder who was it. I just wonder who was that.
That was me.
Huh?
That was me.
Yeah, I thought it was you, but I didn't want to say it was you. But where was you going?
I wasn't going nowhere. They just carried me down to the station house.
Yeah.
Yes.
Name of God, woman, have you been to the station house too?
No, honey, I didn't go. They carried me.
Amen.
Yes. And when you get corn liquor and gasoline together, they're more than apt to carry.
Yes.
Mm-hmm, but it won't all stand you me getting in hurt with no gas, because the gas up there in front with the brass button.
Yes.
And I was in the back.
Yes. 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 It's always like that. Nobody never go. They always can. Nobody ever asked you down there.
Amen.
But you just go down there. There's somebody else like that, too.
Yes, sir. So, Pastor, I came by myself now.
Yeah.
I saw once I wouldn't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
The policeman met me down on the street, me and another fellow together.
Yeah.
And he asked us, could we drive across the street?
Yeah.
I ain't never drove before in my life.
Uh-huh.
But when they asked me, could I drive, I drove the car right straight on home.
Yeah.
Because my liquor left me.
Yeah. Yeah. And? They tell me that so. When the police comes up, the liquor leaves.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And sometimes two things leave.
Yes.
If he ain't in a hurry, the liquor leave and the man too.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Right. You not only can drive straight, you can run straight.
Yes.
I've seen them run straight. Too.
There's a whole lot of them just get full of corn liquor and cut the food.
No,
corn liquor and gasoline.
Yes. Uh-huh,
I tell you, it's bringing about a whole lot of trouble around here. And a whole lot of folks even come to church now. They're full of spirit, but it's not the spirit of God.
No.
They got bad gas.
Yes.
And they tell me they got a kind of a liquor they call block and tackle liquor.
Well, what kind is that?
They just tell me, say they drink one drink.
Uh-huh.
They walk a block and tackle a line.
Yes.
Yeah. And I've seen such thing as that. I see some folks just foolish.
Yeah.
They're drinking that old bad corn liquor.
Yeah.
And they got no business with automobile.
Automobile.
When I had money, I had friends from miles around. When I had money, I had friends from miles around. Ain't got no money, now my friends cannot be found. Some give me a nickel, some give me lousy dimes. Some give me a nickel, some give me lousy dimes. Some people say that old, some say no friend of mine. Be with me when I'm down, I'll be the same when I rise. Be with me when I'm down, I'll be the same when I rise. These St. Louis women, how they think they are too wise. She cooks good cabbage and she calls them turnip greens. How she cooks good cabbage She called them turnip greens. Now she's the best old woman, now the best I've ever seen. On my bay, way down in Polack Town. Bay, way down in Polack Town. Where the police and the snitches, babe, they tore my playhouse down. Take me to Kirkwood, and I make St. Louis all by myself. St. Louis all by myself. When I get there, baby, I hope you haven't got nobody else. What? Well, give me another drink then. That's all right then.
All right, let's break in here and tell you what we've listened to. We had Tommy Johnson and the classic Canned Heat Blues from August 1928. That's the very first CD that Johnny Parth reissued in the document series. That's 5001. That's where it all started. Then we listened to George Carter, Rising River Blues from February 1929, a Georgia Blues package. We had the Delta Big Four and Moner, Let's Go Down to the Valley, from May of 1930. Then Roosevelt Sykes, Nighttime is the Right Time. He's the guy who wrote it, from April 1937. We had a sermon from the Reverend J.M. Gates, Corn Liquor and Gasoline, they don't mix, from April of 1930. And we just got through listening to Stump Johnson out of St. Louis, the Snitcher's Blues, from January 1929. I want to remind you once again that you listened to an interview with Johnny Parth, who originated and guided the Document Project, over 900 CDs, and all of the, well, about 99.9% of the pre-war blues recordings were available in that project. We listened to it here on the air. If you're interested, it also is in my latest book, Blues Before Sunrise Number 3. It's called Guitar Slingers and Backbeaters from the University of Illinois Press. Transcriptions of a couple dozen different interviews are available in that book. To take us on out, let's call on our old buddy, Dr. Clayton.
Get ready, stay out late as you please. Come home drunk and staggering and weak in your knees. But watch out, mama, Dr. Clayton gonna sneak up on you. Yes, I'm gonna whip your nappy head just as soon as I find you. You got some gin head neighbor with an old piece of car. When I ask you where you've been, you tell me off but not far. But watch out, mama, Dr. Clayton gonna sneak up on you. Hey, I'm gonna win you, Daniel, just as soon as I do. You got a habit lately of chewing sin. Soon as I smell it on your breath, I know you're full of gin. So watch out, mama, Dr. Clayton gonna sneak up on you. I'm gonna whip your nappy hair just as soon as I find you. I would quit my job but I like my supper hot. But I done got tired of that jive you got. So watch out, mama.